This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I am joined here with Joshua Zeidner.
It's great to be here, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
So to start things off is Bernie Sanders has this new bill co-sponsored with Representative Ro Khanna from California. And this legislation would require corporations to cover the cost of employees who are reliant on government benefits such as food stamps. And this is, I mean, I support this bill 100%, but it's always been this issue that conservatives have always kind of complained about people using social benefits and how we have to cut social benefits. But not just is this bill a really crucial bill, it also makes the point that basically these government programs, in a sense, are a form of corporate welfare, because these corporations like Amazon and Walmart are not willing to pay their workers a living wage. So with Amazon, it's primarily directed at not so much the tech sector, but they're setting up all these warehouses. And, I mean, eventually there's also a lot of automation, and that's a whole other issue. But these workers get paid very little, and a large portion of them are reliant on government assistance.
Right, that's exactly what's going on, Robert. So, you know, it's a scam that's really kind of been in the works for many, many years. I'd say easily two decades, probably about three now. You know, somewhere along the lines, the HR departments at these corporations discovered something very important. They found out that, you know, their employees are actually eligible for government assistance programs. And, you know, in many cases, they accelerated or industrialized the application and collection of those benefits, and they sort of model their employee payment programs based on the eligibility for those programs. That way they don't have to pick up the tab for things like health care. They don't have to pick up the tab for things like they're eligible for Section 8 housing and food stamps and the variety of different government programs that are designed for people in need. But, you know, as you sort of indicated there, it's really not about helping poverty-stricken people. It's what we're doing is we're subsidizing the costs of corporate labor. That is most certainly a very serious abuse of, you know, these programs' intent and charter. You know, so I think Bernie is doing the right thing. You know, he's trying to address this problem. Because, you know, and he mentioned it before that, you know, it's zeroing out these programs. It's making them completely bankrupt because there's really no limit to how many people could potentially be on these things. And the whole economic model is just so unbelievably screwed up when you really think about it, you know, that we're taking taxpayer money and we're subsidizing, we're basically giving it to Amazon. So the solution that Bernie came up with is, you know, any employee who collects on any of these programs, you know, we just bill it back to the company, which is precisely how the problem should be solved. You know, the company should be liable for the livelihood of their own staff and workforce, which they are not currently. And, you know, the problem extends far beyond that. As I said, it's been going on for decades. It started, you know, with some of the illegal alien workforces. It's almost routine where they come over here. You know, they work completely under the table. So there's not even in this case, like, you know, Bernie's solution actually won't even apply in that case because those people are all off the books. You know, so they'll come here from Mexico or maybe a couple of other key places, and they'll instantly get on those welfare programs, and then they'll start working, and they work for these low end, you know, they'll get employment through these low end, like, employment centers, I guess temp worker agencies, and those agencies know exactly how it works, and they sort of, you know, look the other way when it's prudent to do so, and, you know, they'll sort of help grease the wheels here when, you know, there's a problem there. And yeah, it's a widespread scam of the American people. That's really the it in a nutshell.
Does this relate at all to the monopoly power of Amazon? I mean, that's also a huge issue, and even Trump has talked about that. But does this bill directly address that in any way, or is this only about the government benefit issue?
Well, I think Amazon certainly got quite a number of sweetheart deals rolling. I think we even mentioned that in one of your other shows, you know, that they have special tax breaks for their shipping costs with the USPTO. I'm sorry, the U.S. Post Office. And for some reason, I don't really know exactly how it works, but who's ever in the top management of Amazon, they seem to have access to, you know, these sorts of political favors, which is just yet another example of how screwed up our system is really getting, you know, where specific companies get these sweetheart deals and other companies don't, you know, so you really can't compete. I worked in e-commerce. That was my profession for many, many years. And really, there's very little e-commerce going on outside of Amazon at this point. I mean, you have a couple of, like, boutique kind of retail operations, but for the most part in America, everything is through Amazon. So, you know, is that due to Amazon's corporate excellence, as they claim, or is that due to the fact that they get these special bias deals with, you know, internal government agencies? That's certainly the question that a lot of people need to start asking. You know, I think it's similar with Apple too, and virtually any of these tech giants. You know, they want to promote this sort of image that they are just these great geniuses that no one can even touch in terms of what they're capable of doing. But the truth is that they just know the right people in government.
And the big thing in the news was that all these cities were competing to basically host the next Amazon headquarters. The current one, their main one's in Seattle, but there's this massive competition among cities to host Amazon's next headquarters, and all these cities are proposing these massive tax breaks.
Right, and that's, pretty common for most of the corporate America today. You know, the reason why that there's a regional employer is because they got, you know, they essentially all bid for various sweetheart deals to get them to move to that area. Now, what happens in those cases is, you know, they come in, they provide a job, right? Because according to the local administration of these cities, jobs are good, right? Jobs allow us to employ people, and then they can afford homes, and then we can put them in those homes, we can tax them, and, you know, theoretically the value of the housing will go up. But nothing is really said about the quality of those jobs. That's probably the first thing that people need to start asking. You know, I mean, are we going to be creating happy citizens here, or are we just creating a way for them to bring in enough money to pay their mortgage, you know, in our local area, you know, to kind of keep property prices afloat? Most locales are primarily, these days, the way that they view management is based on property prices. You know, they calculate how many jobs are in the area, how many people we can, you know, how many people can afford to live here and work here. And, you know, what sort of housing they can afford. They make sure that the housing is available or in enough supplies so that they can live there. And that's basically what they judge as success. You know, they don't really think about things like, are we going to have satisfied people here? Are we going to have people who have good careers? Are we going to have, you know, good places for children to develop their skills so that they can go somewhere after high school? You know, all these things are huge problems in these kind of second-tier cities. I lived in Phoenix for a while, as you know, and that's basically the character of life in these places. These kids sort of, like, grow up. You know, their parents got a job at some major corporation like Honeywell or something like that. And the school, there's just really nothing to do there. You know, there's no really place to go. It's not quite like growing up in LA or New York, where there are things happening there and you can be involved. You know, these second tier areas are really quite a bit different in character. You know, and I'm just bringing this up because these areas really want to be, they want to be able to compete with a place like New York or LA, but they don't do it through, you know, due to lack of creativity and lack of sort of insight into how the real economic process really works. Phoenix was really pretty much a joke. You know, they had all these ideas and these people were sort of like parading around these concepts of how they're going to turn Phoenix into something that is comparable to Silicon Valley or LA, and it really got nowhere even close to any of that. People used to call it a potted plant, you know, because they would stick these things into the city thinking that, you know, it would cause it would bring growth, but really what it was everything was very artificial. So it's something to consider, you know, when you're talking about job creation. It's a very multidimensional kind of thing, you know, that is by no means simple.
Yeah, it's not simplistic at all. It's a complex issue because the kind of free market mantra is any job creation is good. And obviously, that sounds good on paper, but traditionally from, say, the 50s to the 80s or even the 90s, basically the goal was to have a solid middle class job to provide that kind of lifestyle of, say, if you wanted to start a family and to have that kind of structure. And I mean, even in the 90s tech industry there was a significant degree of prosperity, but now you get to the point where there's just all this hype about all these tech companies creating all these jobs, and there's a whole facet of issues. Like, we've talked a lot about the housing real estate issues, there's the wages, there's the immigration issues with the H-1Bs, but just the quality of life. These workers are just barely getting by, they're barely sustaining in these places, and not just the Silicon Valley and Seattle. I'm sure it's a problem in places like Phoenix as well, where you have people working in tech and they're just sort of getting by in like a small apartment, and they just have enough to sort of take care of their basic needs. And then on top of that, I mean, the huge issue that we've talked about is they're bringing in tons of foreign workers, and that just further depresses wages. Are you familiar with that bill by Congressman Yoder that I discussed with Kevin Lynn from Progressives for Immigration Reform? This wasn't specifically tech-related, but it's definitely something that the tech industry has lobbied for. So it would eliminate caps on immigration per country, so it'd be primarily beneficial to India.
Sure. I mean, I'm familiar with those sorts of tactics. I mean, they've been after those things for years, and it's very, very obvious that these politicians are being paid off to support these things, because it's very clearly has absolutely zero to do with American livelihoods, you know, to say the least. We have big problems in employment and big economic problems, and we're worried about caps on visas, right? Like, that's so important that we have to address this immediately. And it just shows you, like, their levels of priorities. I mean, if there's anything in particular about this bill that you want to talk about, maybe you could get into detail, but I mean, it's really nothing new. None of these things are new. And, you know, the general story, if you look at it broadly, you know, you take a step back, is that working class people who have to work for a living in general just have no rights anymore. You know, they're like non-people in America. And it's becoming a big, big problem. It seems to get significantly worse every year. So I don't really see. I mean, Bernie seems to be saying the right things, but is he doing the right things, or is he sincere about it? You know, those are all, I think, important questions to ask.
At what point did you really notice a change in the labor environment? A lot of these neoliberal policies go back to the 70s, but when you were working in tech in, say, the 90s, were things even significantly better back then?
Well, I'll tell you, like, some interesting sort of anecdotal stories that probably, you know, have a significant bearing on, you know, the reality of what's happening. You know, I remember when I first entered in the workforce, and that was in the 90s, and, you know, I was kind of like a new crop of people, and I was running into all these sort of old schoolers. You know, they were typically boomers or something. You know, they had very specific ideas about how you worked a job and what who you respected and in what way, and that was all just breaking down in the 90s. And we were kind of like doing it gleefully, like this was going to turn into something really great for everybody. You know, they're essentially deregulating virtually everything about labor. And, you know, they kind of sold us on this image that the whole, you know, it would be this free market labor business. You know, we'd all be like using our creative talents and making so much money, and it's all just going to be so wonderful. You know, that was the kind of story that they ran to people like me. I was a bit young. It was really targeted towards older people. I just entered the workforce very early for a number of years, and then went back out again, went back to school. But that was the story that they were trying to get to us, you know, this like libertarian paradise thing. And, you know, the reality of it was, you know, the way that it turned out was the exact opposite. You know, what they wanted to do is they want to remove the regulations. Then everyone's kind of on their own. They're individuals. And then they're just going to kind of, you know, essentially exploit everybody using these kind of either out-capitalizing or any number of these other tricks, like, you know, bringing in foreign labor. I remember that was happening right at that time, too. Like, I was working at AIG. And there was a guy that was working there like a couple of desks down, and he had just made like several million dollars brokering a deal with AIG and some Indian firm, you know, to bring in loads of these staff, you know, to do all this tech work. You know, so it was still, you know, at that time it was just kind of beginning. And then, you know, these larger consortiums sort of stepped in, like NASCOM or, you know, these large companies like Infosys and Tata, and they just kind of like capitalized off the entire thing, replacing virtually entire social classes of Americans and displacing them from work, which is pretty tragic.
That's the whole problem with this whole social economic strata. So the workers that the Bernie Sanders bill would affect, these are the people sort of towards the very bottom, the working class, people who are dependent on government assistance. And then you have these people who are going into the tech industry with college degrees, well-educated, and people willing to work really long hours. And then those people, I mean, those people had it pretty good in the 90s to some degree, and now they're being exploited, and they can barely get by. So, I mean, what's...
To the point where it's not even worth it anymore.
Yeah,
jumping in. It's really not. I said that the first time we even had one of these discussions. You know, I think it was Sam or something was on there, and he's like, "Would you recommend that young people get into tech?" And I just said, "No." You know, they're going to ream you in every way possible. So it's really just you're not going to benefit from it. You know, these jobs are thankless. They're very long hours. They're extremely stressful. It's like you literally have to do the sort of work that a high-end lawyer has to do, and you get paid nothing to do it. Why would somebody want to do a job like that? You know, I'd rather, if I was in that position, I'd rather just take some low-end job, and then I have my mind is free, and I can sort of not have as much stress. And I think that's the choice that a lot of younger people have made. You know, it's either be extremely stressed out for very little, you know, a little bit of a margin more pay, or just sort of, you know, kind of give up and, you know, take a lower strata job, and then you don't have as much stress, and then you fill your life with video games and stuff like that that you know, millennials are famous for. In a lot of ways, I sympathize with their life attitudes. You know, they're in a tough spot. So
because it's kind of like that that boomer conservative mentality: get an education, work hard, play by the rules, and you'll succeed. But you have this countless generations like the. Of people in their 20s and 30s who did basically they tried to follow that script and they got totally screwed over.
So some people made it, you know, there was a kind of like a select few, but I found those people were just, you know, the most ruthless, or they're the sort of people that are like very good at being mediocre people, you know, like the kind of people that don't really ask much questions or don't rock the boat, and they just sort of, you know, they kind of just play along, and those people seem to have done okay. You know, I can't say that virtually everybody is in that boat, but the vast majority certainly are. And the ones that have any kind of political voice, you know, have been kind of, you know, edged out of those sorts of well-paying positions. And that's the kind of story that we're in right now, you know? I mean, it's getting pretty tragic, if you ask me. You know, you look at some of the other kinds of statistics that surround that, like heroin use. You know, it's no accident that you have joblessness and then suddenly you have a heroin epidemic. You know, these kids just don't have anything to do with themselves. And it's depressing not to have a livelihood. Girls don't pay attention to you, so you're just kind of like, why? You know, and then you turn to things for pleasure. And I guess heroin is one of those things. You know, heroin overdoses are absolutely epidemic right now. I don't know if you've ever looked at those numbers. It's like something like one of the top five causes of death in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, there's that problem. I mean, there's the whole opioid epidemic. And then suicide rates are also on the rise.
Sure. Well, when you rob somebody of like their role in society, like you have no role here, you have no seat. That's essentially what our government is doing. Then that's precisely what's going to happen. Not everybody is so strong emotionally. You know, they can't deal with these things. And then the boomer parents don't sympathize. They think their kid's lazy or, you know, whatever it may be. And that's not really the story. You know, even my own father, he was a boomer. And he just doesn't really compute when I tell him these things. It's kind of like bounces off of his head. It's not in his model of the universe, which is, you know, you get out there and you apply yourself and you get paid. That's just simply not how our country works at this point. And some people certainly want to reinstall the things that would give us that, but those people have enormous opposition. And for the most part, just indifference. You know, people aren't smart enough to even understand what sorts of things need to be done in order to get us back to normal. You know, they have like very, in my view, very childish sort of economic ideas.
And you're talking about political dissonance, whether it's the populist left like Bernie Sanders or the populist right like Steve Bannon. You would say even those individuals don't have the solutions?
Steve Bannon, and I won't comment on, but like Bernie Sanders, I think he has a lot of solutions. I certainly question his sincerity. I think a lot of times, or maybe the Democrat Party is using him as a sort of, kind of like a decoy almost. You know, they let him do his thing, and then Bernie, you know, thinks through these policy ideas and delivers them to the public, like at least conceptually, and then they see the reaction rate, you know, which ones are popular, and then they kind of cut Bernie out of the solution and sell the public a fake version of that actually doesn't really do the job, but is convincing enough that people think they just got that.
And then yeah, they'll find someone else like Elizabeth Warren who they'll try to co-opt his movement.
Sure, who looks, you know, for whatever reason appeals to the same groups of people, and they can calculate all these things quantitatively these days using Facebook. So, you know, they'll find a character who kind of like resembles that person who's really just a paid off sort of shill, you know, who they've kind of been handling for years and years, and they know that the person is reliable in that sense, and they'll put that person in instead. You know, is Bernie, like, if Bernie actually did get elected, do you think he would actually do what he says? I'm not 100% convinced, you know, because he did backpedal a couple of times on some of his policies.
Oh, like immigration, certainly, for sure, because I remember in the interview, he originally said open borders was a Koch brothers conspiracy, and then he backpedaled on that, and now he's like completely open borders.
Right, and you know, I think, to me, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, if Mexicans are arguing that this is some sort of a Nazi policy, they do it in their own country. You know, so all the indicators of falsehoods are there, like hypocrisy and just lack of sort of coherence in the whole program. I'm not buying this idea that there's something wrong with saying that only American citizens should be able to work in America. You know, they want to magnify, you know, these issues that are really somewhat specious. You know, like they're saying it's a racism thing, or they're saying it's something to do with human rights. I don't really think it's related to that. I don't think the problem is really so much related to that. But if it is, I want to see Mexico also implement similar things, which they don't really want to do. So it's a pretty big problem. It doesn't seem to be going away. I mean, Trump made a lot of promises. He has not done a single thing since he was elected, which was a massive disappointment for me, by the way. You know, he got everybody all riled up, said he was going to do all this stuff, and he has not done a single thing. He's not done a single thing for H-1B visas. He's not done a single thing about the problem of illegal immigration. Nothing. So you can quote me on that.
Yeah, for sure. And who knows what Bernie would do if he were in power, how effective he would be. And basically, I mean, our democracy is so corrupt, so even if these figures... I don't know what the motivation of a Trump or Sanders is, even whether they're genuine or not. Even if they want to implement something positive, you have all these corrupt corporate congressmen who will block all of it.
It's disgusting what it's become. I mean, it's like a warehouse. It's like a bargain basement bonanza of political favors at this point. They're not even shy about it anymore. You know, it's become so routine that they don't even attempt to hide the fact that money is influencing their voting decisions. It's gone far beyond anything that anyone has ever considered to be a part of a functioning democracy. And yeah, I mean, anyone's guess how this story is going to end certainly usually doesn't end well. Let's just say that. You know, I'm not going to start pronouncing all these crazy doom scenarios like some people do on the internet, but I don't think it's going to end well, really.
Do you have anything else to say about this particular bill sponsored by Bernie Sanders or about Amazon in general?
Well, I mean, I think I said it before. Like, Amazon has a lot of sweetheart deals going on with, you know, various officials in the U.S. government. They're not a real, you know, they're not really operating a real competitive arena. So their success is due largely, maybe not completely, to, you know, their like unnatural advantages in that sense. And, you know, the fact that Bernie is targeting specifically this company, I don't think is really unfair or biased in any way. I mean, they are special in that regard, and they deserve special treatment, and they deserve special finger pointing. And so any attempt to kind of like accuse Bernie of some sort of you know, foul play, I think is not well placed. But 100% support what he says he's doing. Let's see him actually do it, though. You know, we live in a world of a lot of talk and not a lot of action. So
are you following the whole issue about whether social media companies should be regulated as public utilities? So
yeah.
Earlier on, Trump did talk about this, but now the head of the FCC, he backpedaled on this, and he basically said no, that they should not be regulated as public utilities, because basically if they're that powerful, if they have that much power, as much power as a government entity, then obviously it is a sensible thing to regulate them, because, I mean, take an issue as a political speech. If you want to have a say in politics, you basically need to have access to social media. And if you're censored from social media, then you're basically shut out of having any kind of a voice. So
yeah.
As far as the First Amendment goes, you can make a very strong case that it should be extended to social media, and that social media should be regulated as a utility. And that's something that's been discussed about. And then I have that article from National Review. National Review denounces internet fairness doctrine. And, I mean, in the past, it was actually the left that was saying, the traditional kind of labor left that was saying that corporations had to respect free speech and individual rights. But now the whole thing is that social media is censoring any kind of dissident views, including not just alt-right stuff, but even mainstream conservative stuff is getting censored. And
right.
National Review is they're just putting out their nonsense. Like, oh, it's the free market. They can do whatever they want. So
right. And you notice these voices come in at the exact opportune time to defend what is essentially a propaganda machine. I mean, that's what social media is. Anyone who's dumb enough, like there's one guy that I know, I won't name him because this is probably somewhat embarrassing for him, but you know, he was kind of like a guy, I don't think he really had a lot of financial means, and he decided that, you know, he was going to go online and start a social media account or several of them. And he thought that as long as he posts really good stuff, then, you know, he's going to become famous. And he based this belief on what he thought he saw happening on social media, which is like, you know, a select group of people become very famous because they're saying great things. But that's not really the reality of how social media works. You know, the people who are big on social media have some sort of a special deal with the networks. And what the social media needs to do is it needs to make itself seem as though it's a level playing field. Otherwise, people aren't going to play, right? So that's
and they're doing all kinds of tricks. So
no doubt,
with
no doubt.
Search optimization, if you're a dissident site, Google can change your ranking. And what was the Trump tweet where Trump tweeted that Google and others are suppressing voices of conservatives and are controlling what we can and cannot see? This is a very serious situation.
Not only does Google, you know, kind of delete information, there's also like the omission problem. That's what you just described there. There's also the distortion problem. So famously, there was one example of Google and the Chinese dissidents. I don't know if you ever heard this particular story. Something tells me you have. But somebody found out, this was a long time ago, this is the first example of this, and there have been many since then, where you type in Tiananmen Square into Google.
Oh, yes, I have heard about that, right.
Okay, right. So you type, just for the listeners, so you type Tiananmen Square. I don't know if this still works. They may have adjusted it, being that it was such a controversy and a scandal. But you type in Tiananmen Square into Google.com, and you get, you know, pictures of a guy in front of a tank. But if you type it into Google.ch, you get happy, fun people enjoying their time in Tiananmen Square. So that shows a very obvious sort of agenda on the part of Google, is that you know, they're obviously being paid or influenced by political entities to tell a certain story. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's a very, very much a provable fact that somewhere in Google, you know, I would imagine they have a lot of resources committed to this sort of, these sorts of functions. You know, they'd liaison with people who are in charge of, you know, either national politics or maybe regional politics or factions of regional politics, and they make sure the search engine tells the story that they want to be told, and then they probably get paid for that, or they get tax breaks, or they get whatever it may be. Now, the libertarian in this case will say, well, hey, that's free market, right? I mean, who are we to complain? And that's really... That viewpoint is so erroneous, I don't even know where to start, okay? Like, when you have... We've known for a very, very long time what communication media are, how they should behave, and what are the general rules by which they have to abide by. The idea that a communication medium can just say whatever they want whenever they... That we've been through periods of American history and European history where we know for a fact that that is not true, and in fact... It's very, very damaging to allow such things to proliferate. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of yellow journalism before, right?
Oh, yes.
Right. So we were all taught the basics of yellow journalism when we were in social studies class, you know, learning about America and the 20th century. And, you know, yellow journalism was a period when we didn't have a lot of regulations about how newspapers work in particular. And people were just saying the most awful things constantly. And, you know, the whole world had just become... I think they call it yellow journalism because it's like, I think it like conjures up this image of urine, you know, because it was like everything was just filled with this toxic nonsense and lies. And, you know, the government stepped in and they you know, put certain rules on newspapers. You know, if you say something in this newspaper and it's wrong or it's damaging or it's libelous, then your company's going to get sued, you know, and there's an agency to manage those problems. And, you know, that hooks into our concepts of libel and defamation law, and even earlier than that, you have biblical commandments like thou shalt not bear false witness, right? So it goes way, way back. You know, and like, you know, social media violates this very basic principle of ethics. Don't say shit about people.
I remember in one of our early shows, you said, I forget the name of the law, but there was some law that was put in right before social media that would immune social media from being sued under libel laws.
Right. I'm happy you remember that, by the way. And the name of that law, it was part of the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which arguably was the first, it was really the first big sort of legal set of laws that applied to the internet, right? That was the DMCA. That was the big one. There were a couple of ones before that, small statutory sort of, you know, legal principles, but the big one was DMCA, and what it had in there was something called the Safe Harbor Law. And what the Safe Harbor Law allows you to do is, say you're running a web forum, right? Have you ever run a you run a blog? Right?
Yes, yes.
So okay, and if someone comes into your blog, okay, you don't know who that person is, and they write something, okay, and you choose to publish that. Comment, you are not liable in that case. So it can say extremely damaging inflammatory information, but you will not get in trouble. And the way that the law works is that this person who wrote it is only liable if you know who they are. And of course, you have to admit that information too. So you may know what they are, but you may choose not to even say, and there's no penalty for doing so. So The essence of that law is it negates everything about libel and defamation, allows free reign, which is what we have on the internet. You know, millennials are quite used to this situation where, like, just reading utter freaking garbage on the internet on a daily basis, you know, and they're just like, yeah, I guess everything is a lie in this world, which is kind of like, you know, the mentality of millennials. It's very common, like, that they, you know, a lot of times they have, like, a sort of hopeless mentality. And I can sympathize with that, because if I'm reading horse shit all day long on the internet, it's my only source of information, yeah, I'm going to start to believe that there's really nothing right about this world, and, you know, it's better to just retreat into a world of video games or something like that. But that was the law. So why did it get created? Because these social media companies wanted a way to run like Facebook.com, and anyone can write any sort of utter nonsense that they feel like it without Facebook ever being liable for that damaging, defamatory, libelous comment. And it contradicts virtually, not only does it contradict literally centuries of publishing law, you know, this stuff goes back to Britain. You know, back in the days of early days of publishing, you know, I guess the earliest days of publishing was probably Gutenberg. But let's say, like, you know, maybe like the 1700s, 1800s, you know, they found out that once you have a printing press, people write stupid stuff and spread it around. It can be very damaging. So, they come up with laws. They say, well, if you're the publishing company who published this leaflet that said this damaging thing, you are the one that's liable. We're going to sue this publishing company, not even necessarily the author, who is also partially liable. Right, so that's kind of like how the law worked and how it evolved and how we've always known it to work. And then, you know, we come to the world of the internet, or let's say we come into the world of, like, newspapers, and then later on electronic media like TV, and, you know, you see the same sort of thing carry over into the early days of TV and then the early days of cable and then, you know, the other sorts of similar medium. And then suddenly everything is turned around, you know, with this one stupid law that you can say whatever you want. Like, the internet itself was actually built to accommodate those basic ideas about libel and defamation. That's why we have a DNS system. Have you ever bought a domain name before?
Yes.
Okay, and what did you have to do when you bought the domain name?
You go for a hosting company.
Okay, you go through a hosting company, but they ask you for information, right? They want address.
Your address, all that stuff.
They want your name. They want a way to be able – they basically want your legal identity, right? Because the way the law works is that you cannot publish something without some sort of connection to your legal identity, right? So say that somebody puts something up on there that's libelous or defamatory, or, you know, other sorts of cases like child pornography. You know, they put some content on there that's either illegal or questionable. You know, you'd have to go through litigation to discover whether or not it's legal or not. That's why the DNS system was built that way. But Facebook had a problem. You know, they thought that, well, how are we going to have all of these millions of doofy threads of people posting dubious information under dubious accounts, which may or may not be, you know, have the right name on them, or may or may not have right, they may be false completely.
Yeah, because even if, say, someone did something illegal using Facebook or YouTube or Twitter, Facebook would never be prosecuted.
Right, and they've created that law specifically so that they have total protection. And, you know, the way the law is phrased and the way that the people sort of talk about it who want it in place, it's like as if it's a freedom. You know, like they're hooking us up. You know, like, lucky you get to write whatever you want on the internet now. Isn't that wonderful, kids? You know, it's like they're very disingenuous and it's very insincere.
But that's not really the case now, because now there's this massive censorship on Facebook. People are constantly getting banned for just I haven't really had this problem so much because I don't post a ton of political commentary. But if you're political on Facebook, there's a very high chance of you getting banned. And with
it's
Twitter
happening.
And YouTube. Sure. And YouTube, they take down delete your accounts for political commentary if you get a certain amount of strikes. But another thing they do is they demonetize you. So
sure.
Some people make a living off their YouTube channels, or maybe not a living, but a good chunk of change in the size if they have a sizable following. And if you're a dissident, they can demonetize your account.
Right. So what has happened here? Now we have, instead of like the just way, you know, like instead of implementing justice, as in if somebody says something libelous or damaging or false or in any way misleading, then they're potentially liable for damages. Instead, now we have Facebook, who's making these decisions about what's right and what's not right. They never give explanations for why they've deleted your content, and you're meant to just accept this, like, you know, as if that's not a problem. And Facebook has a complete monopoly on social media. I mean, Twitter is probably the only other alternative there, and you know, I certainly question whether or not they're actually separate companies. I know certainly they share information, and I've, you know, made observations that sort of prove that point. But more or less, they're working together. They certainly share their graph information, you know. So if, like,
well,
you type
because
something,
if you look at advertisements on Facebook are based on your Google search history.
Right, or your Twitter usage, or whatever number of other these, your Tumblr account or something. You know, like, that's also another aspect that a lot of these kids don't realize. It's like they think they have anonymity. You know, and they're uploading pictures of themselves to Tumblr or something naked, you know, or like Snapchat, or I don't even use any of these new ones like WhatsApp or something like that. I mean, a lot of these kids are like sending each other pictures of themselves with no clothes on. And I don't think these kids realize that all that stuff is in a file somewhere. I mean, there's got to be millions of these kids doing this. You know, where the government has a file of, like, their sex life, including, like, explicit nude imagery, that can't be good. So, I mean, to say the least, social media is something that sorely needs some regulation there. I mean, we need to at least get the ball rolling. You know, they need to take a look at it. And they need to say, well, what exactly is Facebook claiming to offer the public, right? That's the first thing that they need to start with. And I think some of that stuff was covered in that that hearing with Zuckerberg. But, you know, in my view, they didn't really ask any
hard
questions.
Which particular hearing?
The one where there were, I forgot exactly which one. I don't really memorize every single time he's shown up in Congress, but. You know, there was a hearing, and, you know, they sort of asked them basic questions, like, because they were concerned about this bias. And to me, it was just like a show, you know, like they're trying to make it look like Congress is actually interested in this problem. And I personally am not convinced that they actually are. You know, so in my view, you know, they need to get a clear concept of what, you know, the FCC needs to be involved in this, and then Congress needs to be involved in this. The FCC chairman needs to be sitting down. All this stuff needs to be recorded. What is Facebook offering the public? Right? What are they claiming to be doing? Robert, could you even address that question yourself? What is the value that Facebook is claiming to be giving the public?
Well, I suppose if it wasn't for Facebook, we wouldn't be doing this show.
Kind of. I mean, there's, but if Facebook didn't exist, there would be other sorts of mediums that don't exploit users in the way that Facebook does. But I suppose there is some truth to that point, you know. But I still think it's very important, you know, that we define what exactly it is Facebook is supposed to be accomplishing and make sure that they accomplish that and only that. You know, they're not taking your information, reselling it to another company. You know, there isn't this open market of data about people. You know, that, you know, back in the 70s, we had this problem, and it was addressed. You know, the Congress found that it was against liberties, against civil liberties, for people to index information about people with, you know, and use it for the wrong purposes. That's part of American, legal history. And there's no reason why those principles shouldn't be applied also to Facebook and Twitter and all the other social media companies. You know, we need to be very clear. You know, it's a communication medium, right? So if you have a communication medium, then they have certain responsibilities to the public. For one thing, there needs to be fairness there. That's how things like public access TV came about. I don't know if you know that. You know, people complained. They said, why should we allow this communication medium to exist if the average person doesn't even get a voice on it? So they invented this concept of public access to TV, and then, like, everybody in the local neighborhood can get their show. And, you know, have you ever even seen public access TV? I don't even think they even have it anymore.
Yeah, I think it must have been big maybe 30 years ago, but no one talks about it anymore.
I caught just the tail end of it, and some of the stuff you would see on those shows was really, really hilarious. You can get, like, clips of it on YouTube. But, you know, my point is that communications companies, and that's what Facebook is, it's a communication medium. They have very specific responsibilities to the citizens of the U.S., and not only are they not meeting those responsibilities, they're not even letting us define what those are. You know, so that's one thing that needs to happen in a really, really bad way. And, yes, it needs to be regulated. You know, it's people like to believe that Facebook is like this for-profit service, as in, you know, you happily upload your photos of your children and whatnot, and you know, Facebook looks at what you're posting and then they decide which ads to sell you. That's not what Facebook's business model is. I even argue that Facebook probably makes a very, very small percentage of their profits, if any at all, off of ads, because no one seems to want to buy them, and anyone who I've ever known to have used them said that they were a really bad, they never actually did anything.
I used ads briefly for something, and the results were very low.
Right. There was also, like, this notion of click fraud that used to be a kind of a buzzword in the internet industry. Like, this idea that, how do you legally verify whether or not a click is actually a click and not someone either simulating it or them completely making up the numbers there? You know, there's really no way to determine whether or not it's a real click or just Facebook is making it up. All they have to do is kind of like send out a couple of internet packets, you know, to your website, and that would look like a click. They don't even need to actually have somebody click the thing. And they're charging for that, so there's no real way to tell. The whole thing is just filled with all this sort of potential and probably likely real fraud, you know, in virtually every aspect of their business. And then you have the question of, you know, how are they collaborating with national entities, like, you know, the example that I just gave, or intelligence agencies. You know, I think there's all sorts of skeletons in those closets, which I can only speculate about. Certainly others have as well. You know, Facebook's history itself, like the way that it sort of was formed and funded, it was closely tied to intelligence agencies. So it's really not a far stretch, I think, to assume that, you know, these devices are being used by those agencies, which, like, you know, evokes, like, basically 1984 type nightmares. You know, it's really not a nice, friendly thing, as a lot of people assume. You know, many people are uploading things on there that are like, you know, their family vacations and stuff. It's really just not for, it should not be thought of as being light. You know, it should not be thought of lightly. I guess is probably the message there.
The key is getting the right regulations, but there's just so many problems. There's the problem of the powerful special interest, but there's just lack of innovative ideas. You get people maybe in Congress who, well, maybe possibly they want to do the right thing, but they just lack, they don't have the same skills as the people in the tech industry, so they're not able to craft like the right bill, and that's an issue.
Right,
as well.
I think there's certainly like a lack of expertise and knowledge among political people on how to like kind of get it right, you know. And I rarely ever see, they may actually know how to get it right and they just don't say, you know, they're being paid off, or they're being paid to sort of, you know, they're kind of like gagged by some sort of either legal or economic incentive, you know. But it suffice to say that the discussion is not really happening. Certainly I think social media, like, they're going to regulate it, but they'll probably do it in a way that looks like they're fixing the problem, but they really don't. That's likely what's going to happen.
Or if they regulate it might just be to violate our privacy more.
Yeah, they'll just put the pretense. You know, they'll listen to people like us, make sure our names are never put on anything, and they'll come up with a new person who, you know, kind of resembles us in a very superficial way, and they'll have that person sort of deliver some kind of fake. This has like been the story of American politics for like the last 20 or 30 years. And, you know, social media has, if anything, made that much, much worse, because it allows them to perform metrics on these interest subjects. Like, they can find out specifically how many people in a specific area of a specific demographic are interested in something like privacy. And maybe they can deliver something that looks like it's sufficient to those people while not doing anything. Facebook is a very insidious thing.
You would say Facebook more than YouTube or Twitter or Google.
I think they're all together. You know, I think it's pretty clear that they all
work together.
Yeah,
YouTube is officially owned by Google. And actually, when YouTube was independent, they had censorship, but it wasn't quite so bad. But as soon as Google bought YouTube, that's when their censorship and things started getting really bad.
Well, I think that, you know, there's probably competition to a limited degree, but, you know, they all agree in the same things, you know, about who gets to do what. And, you know, they have some competition, probably because they don't really completely know what is actually going to work and what's not, you know. So they try a number of things and let this guy sort of operate on his own, or let this person operate on their own. If they succeed, then, you know, they pump more money into it and just kind of keep the whole ball rolling. But, you know, there are good voices out there. I don't want to say it's just crickets. I think I mentioned before, there's a guy named Yasha Levine. He did a book called Surveillance Valley, which outlines some of these things. It did get some interest, but not as much as I probably would have liked to have seen.
Have you read the book? I think he's affiliated with Mark Ames.
Yeah, he is. He tweets. You know, they're kind of like in a little tweet circle together. I don't really know him personally, but I'm just a fan of his. And you know, he wrote a pretty good book. But there have been others too. You know, there was also the guy, what's his name, Schwartz. You know, the guy who started Reddit, and he was pretty outspoken, and, you know, he supposedly committed suicide. I won't comment any further on that, but that was the official story. I don't know if I even have a right to question that. I don't know enough about it, but it seems a little suspect to me that somebody in the prime of his life, you know, who had so many things going for him, and, you know, everyone was paying attention to him, and suddenly he decides to kill himself. There was also the other guy who started Diaspora. So Diaspora is like an open source social media platform. Like, you can download Diaspora and start your own social network right now, no money at all. And the guy who started that also supposedly committed suicide. His name was Ilya something. So, you know, those people have been around, but you have to question, you know, what exactly is going on here? You know, why do these people always seem to meet with a tragic end to their lives? Is this some sort of coincidence, or are people who are involved in privacy rights just mentally unstable people? I suppose that's one explanation. Another explanation is people don't want them doing that. So
yeah, so one, I mean, there could be a nefarious interest involved. That's one possibility. Maybe people who are exposed to so many ugly truths, maybe that drives them to suicide. Who knows? That could be true
as
well.
That's very possible, and that has happened before. It's very possible. There's like what's his name, Bobby Fischer. You know, he sort of just—I think he just sort of bit off more than he can chew, and just kind of lost it. And it's a fact that he became a very mentally unstable person. So that could have been the explanation as well.
It does seem to be that dissident politics attracts a lot of mentally unstable people. So, Joshua, is there anything else you'd like to add about the Bernie Sanders bill, about corporations that rely on government subsidies for their workers? I mean, one more thing I'll just point out is, before I get back to you, is with Walmart, destroyed all these small businesses, which provided a pretty solid middle-class standard of life. And basically most of their workers are pretty much at the very bottom of the economic ladder and largely dependent on government subsidies. So Walmart's responsible for a lot of poverty. And Walmart's been around for quite some time. These Amazon warehouses are a fairly new phenomenon, and they're spreading rapidly as distribution increases, creating a lot more low-wage jobs. Now, that's the thing, is you get these politicians who brag about creating jobs. And one thing is, conservatives like to talk about Texas as an economic success story. But, it's technically true that Texas has created more jobs than California, but they're overwhelmingly these low-wage jobs.
Right. I'll leave your listeners with an anecdotal story that you'll probably find fairly interesting. As you know, I spent time in Germany. I worked there. Yeah. So Walmart attempted to actually set up shop in Germany at one point. I don't know the exact time frame. I'm going to say something about 20 years ago, maybe. And their employment practices were so utterly abysmal that Germany literally told them to take a hike. And this was after they had committed a significant amount of resources to existing in Germany. So, if that doesn't speak straight to the point about whether or not Walmart adds to our lives or subtracts to our lives, I don't know what else would. It literally was banned from Germany, and I really hope to see Americans get a little bit more proactive with how things are sort of shaping up around here in America. No one seems to really care that there's a complete lack of jobs for virtually anyone. Your choices are either do a highly professional position, in which case you have to work in a metro area where the cost of living is extremely high, or you live out in the country and there are no jobs or anything that you would really call like a livelihood. So it's a big problem, and I really hope that Americans sort of raise their awareness of what's going on.
And the other issue. The other issue that's going to be huge is automation, but that's a topic for a whole other show.
Well, I'm not really sure how big of a problem that really is, because automation also requires a significant technological base, and all this automation needs to be supported by people.
So what could end up happening is it could shift the labor force from less low-skilled jobs but a greater demand for high-skill jobs. So, that's one possible scenario. But then if that happens, then they'll say, oh, well, you need more H-1Bs to fill those jobs.
Right, and that's been their solution, right? So that it looks like this progress, this technological progress is actually benefiting us, but really, we're just sweeping the problem underneath the carpet. In my view, a more peaceful, sort of more prosperous future is something that's we're scaling back a lot of technology. And that was sort of the vision in the 70s, or so it seemed. And then it shifted somewhere in the late 80s back to plastic fantastic, let's build a rocket ship to Mars or something like that, So I'm kind of more in line with you know, the Kunstler view of the future, you know, or the Dmitry Orlov view of the future, that we should learn how to deal a little bit more as lower tech people, you know, because it reflects on how you view the purpose of life, right? I mean, why are we here? You know, what exactly are we trying to do? It starts to shed some light on some of those age-old questions, which I think different people answer in a different way.
Joshua Zeidner, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
You're so much welcome, and it was an excellent show, and thank you very much for having me on, Robert.